Hello, and welcome to The Backside of Water, a podcast that delves into the rich history, awesome stories, and fascinating details behind your favorite Disneyland attractions. I'm Annie Rugit.
And I'm Alex Stewart, and let me be the first to welcome you to part two of our exploration of It's a Small World. On the first episode in this two-parter, we covered the broad history of the World's Fair and Walt Disney's involvement with quite a few of the main attractions at the fair itself. In this episode, we're going to be exploring the nuts and bolts of the creation of It's a Small World, the attraction itself.
In fact, we boarded a cruise ship that is traveling around the world showcasing all the amazing artifacts from the original iteration of It's a Small World, the version that appeared at the World's Fair. And on this episode, you, our wonderful listeners, are going to join us on an audio tour of all these wonderful artifacts.
I'm especially excited because the Small World exhibit was designed and is operated by the wonderful Imaginarium team that was created using the funds from my family's root beer empire. Now, I can't wait to see what Dr. Sneck and the team has cooked up in here.
Well, what are we waiting for? Let's head in.
Ah, welcome to the happiest exhibit that ever sailed. Do you have your reservation card?
We sure do. Here you are, my good man.
Perfect, thank you. Ah, you are the hosts of that Disneyland podcast, aren't you? The Disney Bottom Feeders podcast?
Actually, it's called The Backside of Water, but yeah, we are indeed the hosts.
Well, it's an honor to have you aboard. Please, head right in.
Thanks so much. Can you believe we are in here, Al? It's like a dream come true.
Sorry. I just have a weird feeling. That guy in the front who took our tickets, I've never seen him in the Imaginarium lab before.
Oh, I'm sure it's nothing. They probably need so many people to run these exhibits that they ran out of Imaginarians to do it. I wouldn't worry too much about it, Al. You don't want your experience in this awesome exhibit to be tarnished by a weird feeling, okay? This is a happy place.
You know, you're right, Annie. I need to focus on the amazingness of this place. And speaking of which, look over there. That's where we begin. It's a little theater.
Oh, it must be the introduction video for the exhibit. It looks like the next showing is starting. Come on. Hello, and welcome to the happiest exhibit that ever sailed. Here you will find over 500 artifacts that were used to design, create, and sustain the It's a Small World attraction during its time at the 1964 and 65 World's Fair. Your journey into yesteryear begins here, with a quick video that will help prepare you for what you are about to experience. In fact, this is a once-lost video that was intended to show the press who were covering the fair at the time. As a reminder, during the video presentation, please refrain from flash photography. Once the video is completed, you may enter into the exhibit itself. Now, sit back, relax, and enjoy the show.
Hello, I'm Barton Holloway, and I'd like to take you on a journey. A journey that includes such shining stars as the man behind the world's most lovable mouse, a Children's Relief Foundation, and one of America's favorite colas. In February 1963, a representative from UNICEF, or the United Nations International Children's Emergency Fund, took a trip down to the happiest workshop on Earth and met with the man in charge. Mr. Joel Fowler, that is. Fowler was the construction manager at Mr. Walt Disney's budding but very popular theme park, Disneyland. This UNICEF representative had a wild-eyed idea that Disney and company may be interested in creating a themed attraction that would represent UNICEF at the upcoming World's Fair. The UNICEF representative had barely begun to share his dream when Fowler cut him off to explain that Mr. Disney and the rest of the team were already much too busy to work on a new project. He explained that the team was already working overtime on an audio animatronic Abe Lincoln, while also putting together a pirate-themed walkthrough experience that they were working on to be released at Disneyland later down the road. There was surely no way that the team could work on yet another project. The UNICEF representative left the meeting feeling less than excited about being turned away from Mr. Disney. Meanwhile, across the country, the board of directors for the soda pop company Pepsi Cola were trying to decide which attraction they would finance for their involvement in the World's Fair. They were going back and forth until finally, at the 11th hour, the actress Joan Crawford, wife of company president Alfred Steele, reached out to her friend Walt Disney to see if he would design an attraction that would represent Pepsi-Cola well at the fair. She reasoned with the board that they would simply have to agree with whatever Mr. Disney came up with because the company had waited so long to act, and because other companies like Ford, General Electric, and Kodak had all put their trust in Disney's magical creative powers. She insisted that Walt was the only man who could help them in their time of need. Meanwhile, back at Disney Studios, Walt Disney received the news that Mr. Fowler had turned the UNICEF representative away and proceeded to remind Fowler who was the boss. Disney then turned to his staff with an idea that would work for UNICEF and his friend Miss Crawford. He said, "Pepsi-Cola is willing to sponsor whatever we do, and it'll be a salute to UNICEF. I've got an idea for a little boat ride." And the rest is, as we say, history. Mr. Disney's Little Boat Ride, It's a Small World, is set to premiere at the World's Fair later this year. It is a journey that will no doubt charm and delight you and your guests at the fair. Thank you, and enjoy your time here at the 1964 World's Fair.
Wow, that was amazing. I had no idea that Pepsi was in the 11th hour crisis like that, or that Joe Fowler straight up turned UNICEF away.
That video was really informative, and I'm very curious to know what happened to the host, Barton Holloway. Seemed like a very interesting dude, for sure.
No doubt.
Whoa, Al, look over there. It looks like a chunk of some sort of metal structure. I wonder what that has to do with the Small World.
Whoa, that's incredible. Annie, that's a piece from one of the Towers of the Four Winds.
The what?
The Tower of the Four Winds. Okay, so at the World's Fair, It's a Small World was housed in a fairly nondescript building. Because of this, Walt asked famed Imagineer Rolly Crump to design a weenie, or something to draw people into the attraction. Crump made a sculpture out of metal rods to grab people's attention. This was the 120-foot high Tower of the Four Winds. It was quite the whimsical space-age structure with spinning starburst, weather vanes, discs, and hoops of all kinds of cheerful colors. It was a landmark at the fair, and this little piece here is a part of that tower.
But that's not what's in front of the ride today, right?
No, unfortunately, the cost of shipping the Tower of the Four Winds from New York to California was more than it cost to build it in the first place. So sadly, it was dismantled and never reassembled. I'm amazed they were able to find such an iconic and rare piece of Disney history like this. It blows me away.
Rare and priceless. Please, be sure not to get too close or damage anything. Thank you. We would hate for the value of any of these pieces to be compromised.
We'll be sure not to touch anything. Also, I meant to ask earlier, are you one of the members of Dr. Sneck's team who put this exhibit together?
Why, yes. I worked closely with the good doctor to get this exhibit in tip-top shape.
Hey, that's great. He sure does love being out here on the open ocean, doesn't he? His room is on the Lido deck, hallway 3, right?
He does indeed, and yes, it is.
You know, I still need to stop over and say hello. If you see him before I do, will you tell him hi for me?
I certainly will. And remember, no touching.
Sheesh, what a grump.
And a liar.
What? What are you talking about, Al? It only makes sense that we shouldn't touch this stuff. It's priceless after all.
No, not about that. I made sure to ask him about Sneck for a reason, and believe it or not, his answer confirmed my suspicions.
Yeah? What do you mean?
Well, he said Sneck loves the ocean, but In reality, Sneck can't stand the ocean. He gets insanely seasick anytime he steps foot on a boat. But the thing that really makes me suspicious is the fact that Sneck refused to come on the cruise because of his hatred for the ocean. I just spoke with him back at the lab this morning.
Okay, that is a little fishy. But what do you think is going on?
I'm not too sure yet, but you can bet I'm going to get to the bottom of this. In the meantime, look over there.
Hey, I know that woman in that photo with Walt and all those other dudes. That's the amazing Mary Blair. Man, she was a powerhouse in the world of Disney around this time, and her career is fascinating. She actually started out working for the animation department at MGM, but would eventually move over to UB iWorks Studio to work with her husband.
Wait, she worked for UB iWorks?
Yeah. Wait, why does that name sound familiar?
Because he was the dude who designed Mickey Mouse.
That's right. Okay, didn't he and Walt have somewhat of a falling out?
Well, kind of. The two had a tumultuous relationship, without a doubt, which eventually led UB to leave the Disney Studios and start a rival company. Eventually, his studio would end up going belly up, and he would come back on staff at Disney.
That's crazy how everyone seems to be connected in that industry.
No doubt about it.
Eventually, Blair would join Disney Studios for a short time, working on the art for Dumbo, early versions of Lady and the Tramp, and an unreleased sequence for Fantasia that wouldn't end up being released until the 1990s. She'd also end up leaving Disney, but then coming back to travel with Walt and the team that became known as El Grupo, the touring group that would explore South America and end up creating the film Saludos Amigos as a result of that trip. Which, by the way, I saw an exhibit about El Grupo. Beautiful work from
There's
that
group. There's a documentary
group.
About it, too.
Yeah. She would go on to work on animated films for the company for the good part of a decade and would end up leaving the company again after the completion of Peter Pan. She went on to be a graphic art powerhouse working for some of the biggest companies in America. But when the time came for Walt to design this little boat ride attraction for Pepsi and UNICEF, he knew the only person capable of creating the atmosphere for such an attraction would be the one and only Mary Blair.
Of course.
She agreed to work on the project, and it was her iconic visual style that would be the foundation for which It's a Small World would be built upon. Her color palette, bright, warm, and vibrant, is what makes Small World such a visually stunning little boat ride.
And speaking of boat ride, that guy in the picture next to her is the famous legend Claude Coates. He was the one responsible for laying out the design of the river the boats would follow while riding through what at the time was known as the Children of the World ride.
Al!
What?
Look over there. They have a display with the original doll figures of the attraction!
Oh man, they look so incredible up close.
Oh, amazing. If I recall, wasn't it the power couple Mark and Alice Davis who worked on the design of these dolls?
You are correct. So Mark Davis's silly sense of humor can be seen throughout the attraction, especially in areas like the little ducks are taking turns quacking the melody to the song, places like that. Now, in fact, Imagineers would find inspiration for the gags seen in the attraction from all over the place. There's a penguin sequence that was inspired by a sculpture that Imagineer Yale Gracie found on Walt's desk, even. But getting back to the dolls, Walt himself was also integral to the design of these as well, with Blaine Gibson doing the actual sculpting of the dolls. It may go unnoticed, but every human figure on the attraction has the same head shape and facial structure.
Now, what is the reason for that?
Well, some argue that this design doesn't hold up well today, as it doesn't capture the diversity of the world. The original intent was to show that we are all the same at the core of who we are as people, after all.
That makes sense then, why they would make that choice. I love the costume design on this attraction as well. Alice Davis knocked it out of the park with the variety and detail of the figures' costumes, don't you think?
I couldn't agree with you more, but oh my word, look over there, Annie. It's a collection of the toys featured throughout the ride.
Whoa, these toys really do capture the childlike nature of the attraction and remind us that this is the world seen through the eyes of a child, don't you think?
Oh, they absolutely do. Rolly Crump and Jack Fergus were the two responsible for creating these 3D set pieces.
I know. know Rolly Crump, but who was Jack Fergus?
Now, Jack Fergus was a painter and sculptor who worked on a ton of attractions in Disneyland and Disney World as well, like Pirates of the Caribbean, Haunted Mansion, the Jungle Cruise, and even the beloved Maelstrom in Epcot. Now, his wheelhouse was miniatures, and he was an Imagineering legend. So these guys made the 3D experience from Mary Blair's original art.
Wow, this attraction really featured an all-star cast in the Imagineering world, didn't it?
It really did, and nothing was more iconic than the song.
That song, yes. Speaking of which, Al, look, it's the original sheet music for the song written by the legendary Sherman Brothers. Cool.
Annie, this might be one of the greatest things I've ever seen through my own eyes. This song changed the entire attraction.
Wow. How so?
So originally, Walt wanted a simple ride. He didn't want politics or a story. He wanted to express the World's Fair's theme of peace through understanding by showing children's joy around the world. Part of that experience was to have all the children sing their national anthems throughout the attraction.
Hey, that's a great idea.
It was great, but it didn't work. The idea was cute, but as soon as they tested it, it was definitely a no-go. Guests would hear all the anthems at once, and it was a cacophony of stress the entire ride.
Ugh, yeah, actually I can hear that now, and I don't like it.
Now, the problem was, with there being no story to the attraction, the experience was what was going to be front and center on this attraction. And the song, along with the visuals, is what people would remember. Walt needed a song that would hit audiences in a powerful way. Thankfully, he had arguably two of the strongest songwriters of their generation, Richard and Robert Sherman. So Walt tasked these guys with writing a song that could be sung in multiple languages without sounding like a complete racket. The brothers would go on to write a song that the brothers saw as more of a prayer for peace than a song. Their inspiration for the name to this tune came from Harriet Burns, the first female employee hired at Wed Enterprises. So one day, while speaking to the Sherman Brothers, she said in passing, "Well, it's a small world after all." And the title stuck. I know, that became the name for the entire attraction, and It's a Small World has gone on to become one of the most re-recorded songs in history, all from a passing line from a Wed employee. How incredible is that?
I love those kind of stories. And not to mention, it's also the most earwormy song ever created.
Any truer words have never been spoken.
Al, oh my gosh, over here, it's a ticket to the original attraction at the World's Fair.
That is awesome. So when the attraction opened April 22nd, 1964, it was 95 cents for adults to ride and 60 cents for children. Now, the majority of the attractions at the World's Fair didn't cost anything to ride, but with this one it was a little different because all the proceeds collected from these tickets sold were donated directly to UNICEF. And the public could not get enough of the attraction. In the 2 years it was open, over 10 million people rode it.
Oh my gosh, that sounds like an amazing experience. I'm sure it made the fair an absolute hit.
You know, it did, but Walt's involvement in the fair didn't necessarily make the fair a financial success.
No?
Believe it or not, no. Unfortunately, the runners of the fair anticipated that the number of people coming out to the fair would be much, much higher than the number of people who actually showed up. Sadly, in the end, the fair would be a financial failure, with investors only receiving pennies on the dollar from their investment in the fair.
Gosh, what a bummer. So after the fair ended, what happened?
Well, Flushing Meadows stayed beautiful, and some of the architecture and art from the World's Fair remained and is there today. But much of the beauty, majesty, and wonder of the fair was disassembled, put into storage, or straight up thrown away.
Oh, gosh, that's awful.
Annie, you are telling me. Imagine how amazing it would be if there was some sort of museum dedicated to this 1964 World's Fair. Thankfully, though, Walt already had a plan for what he would do with his attractions that were housed at the World's Fair.
That's right. In our last episode, we learned that Walt would take his attractions from the World Fair and house them at Disneyland, right?
That is correct, my friend. And It's a Small World was no exception to this move. They would take every single piece of the attraction, including these boats. Annie, look!
These Small World boats are so much more important than anybody really gives them credit for.
Yeah?
Totally. They were designed by none other than the world-famous vehicle imagineer Bob Gurr and created by Aero Development for this attraction specifically. But the boat ride concept actually had some unintended consequences as well, on the positive side. During the fair, Walt noticed that all the other fair attractions featured long wait times, which was certainly frustrating. But with Small World, it seemed like the wait was fairly non-existent. This is because the design team for Small World hit a genius travel idea that they had almost taken for granted. When Walt pitched the idea for a boat ride, it is likely that he wasn't thinking about the fact that the boats could hold a ton of guests. But in reality, these boats held a lot of people. Additionally, more than one boat was able to make the voyage at a time, which allowed them to fill the waterway with an unending line of boats running through the canal. This was an amazingly effective way to get a huge amount of people through the attraction every single hour. And for those who are into theme park nuts and bolts, guest attraction efficiency is huge.
That's right. In fact, the success of this boat ride concept created at It's a Small World was so successful that it changed the way we experience other attractions today, primarily Pirates of the Caribbean.
Oh, I hadn't thought about that. Can you tell me more?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. For those who have listened to our Pirates of the Caribbean episode, they'll remember that Pirates was originally intended to be a walkthrough attraction. But once Walt saw the success of Small World in regard to its efficiency, he decided to reimagine how people would experience his pirate-themed attraction. Instead of walking through, they would ride a boat through the experience instead. This way, he could do a couple of things. He could control the experience more than with unpredictable foot travel, and he would make the ride all the more efficient.
Okay, that is amazing how this little boat ride, It's a Small World, can change everything. So, you were saying that once the fair was over, they shipped everything back to Disneyland?
That's right. Believe it or not, it was designed and built in California first, then dismantled and reassembled in New York. It was then dismantled again and sent back to California, where it would find its eventual home in Fantasyland. In fact, there are rumors that certain set pieces still have the shipping labels and stickers on them explaining where to put the pieces once they made it to their final destination.
That would be so cool to see.
Oh yes.
Look over there. It's a map comparing the route of the original layout and the Disneyland layout. Okay, this boat path looks different than where we have it now, like much smaller.
Well, if I recall, that's because the new and improved and larger version of It's a Small World would open at Disneyland in 1966, and the show building itself was about 30% bigger at Disneyland than the World's Fair. Oh, look right there. It actually looks like there's a little plaque here with a quote from Rolly Crump explaining the differences.
The New York sets were placed in the same order at Disneyland, although some were different, right or left side. But we added quite a lot. The European section was built at least a third larger than the World's Fair, so I had to piece the sets to fill the space. We never had a North Pole at the fair, which I designed for Disneyland along with the islands of the Pacific. We had to completely rebuild every set that was at the fair, re-canvas them, repaint them, re-glitter them, and then add another third to the ride. Ooh.
Wow, that sounds like a ton of work. And speaking of work, it's important to note that they also had to build an entirely new facade for the exterior of the attraction.
Oh, that's right. There was no Tower of the Four Winds for people to meet under anymore.
That's right. And also, another little thing to keep as a tidbit here, and I haven't seen it anywhere in the exhibit, is speaking of that Tower of the Four Winds, it reminds me of the entrance and exit to It's a Small World. Did you know that It's a Small World is one of the first places, it's noted as the first place, where guests would exit into a gift shop? Is that surprising to you, Annie?
It's kind of surprising to me.
but it's also such a Disney way. And it kind of adds some excitement to that little gift shop that you still exit out to at Disneyland. At least I personally think that's exciting.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. But I wonder why they didn't have the idea before. Maybe they just had so much merchandise because of Mary Blair's designs and all the artists stacked on this ride. They wanted to share dolls.
Yeah, it's a good question.
I have things. Yeah.
I have no answer for you. I have no answer for you. That's one the world may never know, Andrea. That's going to keep me in existential dread throughout the next fortnight. I don't know. You should try to Google it once we get back to shore.
I'll Google it, and then I'll tell you so that you can sleep easy.
Oh, you're a pal. You're just a pal. Sorry. So since the Tower of the Four Winds was too expensive to ship like we talked about, Walt tasked Rolly Crump with building a new facade to replace the Tower of the Four Winds. Crump would take the inspiration from the Mary Blair drawings and create a whimsical facade, with the focal point being a clock with a face on it that would move back and forth, a piece that Walt insisted must be included. The original version was white and gold.
Isn't that what it is currently?
You are correct, my astute little friend. But over the years, it would change colors quite a few times. Thankfully, modern Imagineers see the value of nostalgia, so the old facade has been repainted to match the original white and gold look from 1966. And yes, I did say repainted because I wanted to feel like I was from 1966. Look at the repainted face.
Your soul is from 1966.
Dusty.
Speaking of which, here's a photo of the attraction on opening day. What are those people pouring into the water?
Whoa, this is an amazing photo, Annie. This photo is capturing the moment when these 16 children from around the world, invited by Walt himself, poured water from, quote, the seven seas and nine major lagoons, unquote, into the water that the boats would ride through. You can even see Walt pouring a very special amount of water from the rivers of America in there as well.
Oh, I love that idea. And those doves flying overhead in the photo are also just gorgeous. I'm assuming that they were there to represent peace?
You are correct. Annie, you should be an ornithologist.
Thank you.
It's a studier of birds. I don't know if you knew that.
I thought maybe I should be a symbologist. Because I know the symbolism of things. But I can be an ornithologist, too. Or ornithologist.
An ornologist.
Orangologist.
You're really good at identifying citrus. Okay, so we digress. I mean, again, yes, the doves do represent peace. I mean, after all, peace is what this attraction is all about.
You know, it's also so amazing that this ride looks so similar today to what it looked like on opening day in 1966. Like, we could just step back into that photo and it would be modern day.
You know, it seems that way, but over the years, there have been little tweaks to the attraction. They're very small. For instance, the holiday overlays would come in 1997, and in 2008, when you and I were working there...
Ah, they added the Disney and Pixar characters. I remember there was quite the uproar when they added those characters.
So, to me, that uproar shows how fiercely devoted to Small World fans are. It's amazing that adding just simply 37 new Disney and Pixar-inspired characters could cause such a stink. But over time, people have gotten used to them, and they really do, in my opinion, blend in fairly well.
I agree. Ow, wait, I almost forgot. An addition I do remember was one of the little girls holding a red balloon at the foot of the Eiffel Tower.
Wow, Annie, good eye and memory. I never would have seen something so seemingly benign.
Yeah, actually, Al, it is a loving tribute to none other than Mary Blair. And I love that. With the short hair and quirky style of the figure, it embodies the spirit and eccentric nature of the artistic master perfectly.
It really is perfect.
Al, I hate that we are done with the exhibit.
Wait, what are you talking about? We still have, from my precise calculation, 75 other artifacts to see.
I love that you kept count.
Of course I have, Annie. I want to see everything I possibly can. Are you crazy?
A true small world nerd.
Through and through. And I'll be darned if I don't see every artifact that this exhibit has to offer. Now, just around the corner here, we're going to find...
a wall?
Hey, that's not supposed to be there. Annie, look at this map. Clearly it shows there should be another room to this exhibit, and this here should be the entrance.
Yeah, that is odd. Wait, do you hear that?
Hear what?
It's a weird zapping sound coming from behind the wall. Listen, listen.
I do hear it. How weird. Annie, we need to get to the bottom of this.
Look, Al, the wall is one of those movable dividers. If we can just find the edge, we may be able to see what is going on behind this thing.
Great idea. Oh, there's a corner. Let's go test your theory.
Okay, let's slowly move it so no one notices. If we do this correctly, we can squeeze between the wall and the divider. Okay, there. I'm through. Come on, Al. Come through.
Oh, man, that's a tight squeeze. Oh, that's lucky. Annie, we snuck in behind one of the display cases. But whatever you do, don't touch the case.
That's right. No touching. Come on, Al. You're starting to sound like that Maxwell guy.
Oh, no, it's not that, Annie. I was there when Sneck designed these things. The display cases are made of quintuple pane, one-ton, tempered glass, balanced on a system of highly sensitive weight triggers on top of a gyroscopic floor stand to prevent them from going off with the commotion of the waves interacting with the ship. If there is any detection of tampering with a display case, not wave-related, a silent alarm is tripped and notifies the security central hub.
Man, these things are high tech.
They sure are. They have to be. They're holding one of the most valuable Disney memorabilia collections outside of the Disney archives. If anybody were to get their hands on this stuff, they could become very, very rich. That's why they hired Sneck to create this impenetrable case system.
Okay, I don't mean to cut you off while fanboying over Sneck's awesome display cases, but look over there.
Over where? Oh! Hey, is that Maxwell dude?
Yeah, it sure looks like it. What is he doing? It looks like he's holding a flamethrower.
Wait, why does that thing look so familiar?
Al, he's pointing it at the display case full of Small World figurines. He's gonna burn the whole case down.
Don't worry, Annie. Those cases are 100% flame retardant. Nothing, and I mean nothing, can get through them.
Hey, that's not a flamethrower. Look, Al, he pointed that gun thing at the case and everything in the case just disappeared.
Oh no, it looks like he's using it to steal all the Small World artifacts. Annie, we need to do something.
But what are we gonna do? We have no way of stopping him.
Okay, I have an idea, but we need to get a little closer. Follow me.
Oh, tripped over the edge of the display case.
Go investigate.
That guy is coming this way. What do we do?
Oh, there's nothing we can do now, Annie.
Well, what do we have here?
Get your hands off me!
Ah, two uninvited guests. Oh, if it isn't the intrepid and pesky podcast hosts.
That's right, Maxwell. And we know what you're doing.
You'll never get away with this.
I already am.
Hey, what is that thing anyway?
Oh, this thing. This is what I call the Transparay.
Creative title.
What does it do, anyway?
He don't have to answer that.
Come now, Thurl. I'll never pass up the opportunity to share the genius of my inventions. This device here is capable of disassembling the particles of an object, transferring them through space-time, and reassembling them somewhere else.
So it's a...
transport array, exactly, my dear.
So where are you transporting the artifacts, Maxwell?
Come now, Mr. Stewart. Do you think I'm so foolish that I would go blabbing that kind of information? Let's just say it's going to an undisclosed location.
Hey, Mr. Maxwell, one of Mr. Casablanca's men just reported that the first case of artifacts successfully made the jump.
Casablanca?
I just love it when everything goes according to plan. Tell Mr. Casablanca that the rest of the items will be transported shortly.
Yes, Mr. Maxwell.
You're stealing the entire collection?
Of course, the buyer wants the complete collection.
And who exactly is this buyer?
Enough questions. Thurl, stand back. I'm going to send these two somewhere where they won't be able to tell a soul about what we're doing here. Ah, the perfect location. Farewell, my friends. Oof! Thurl, you fool, what are you doing?
I'm blowing my cover to buy my friend some time.
Wait, Freddy Martin? What are you doing here? What's going on?
No time to explain, Al. Run!
Guards, block the door!
Guys, the door is the only way out. Those goons look pretty big.
Gotta think of something. Gotta think of... What happened?
Oh, it looks like the doors were blown off their hinges.
Good plan, Al.
Oh, I hate to say it, Anne, but that wasn't me.
Then who was it?
Well, it looks like you could use some assistance.
Snack?
What are you doing here? I thought you were at the Imaginarium.
Well, I was, but once I saw that every rate distribution alarm in the display cases in this wing were going off, I made a call to security dispatch. They told me that everything was okay, and that it was just a malfunction in the case. But clearly that couldn't be, since these cases were built to perfection. As such, I thought it might be good to come down and investigate for myself. As you can see, I'm very glad I did.
Well, so are we.
Now, let's get out of here, my friends.
Not so fast.
Stephen Maxwell, could that really be you?
In the flesh, hello, Snick. It's been too long.
Do you guys know each other?
Does roommates at MIT count as knowing each other?
Wait, you two were roommates?
Sadly, yes, we were. That is until he was kicked out of the school after the unethical practices he was performing.
What one man calls theft, another calls innovation, Snake.
That, Maxwell, is where you and I never saw eye to eye.
And we never will.
I see my prediction about the transport array came true.
Prediction? What prediction?
You see, Mr. Martin. Mr. Maxwell and I started our work on our senior year thesis together. It was a device that could transport objects from one place in space-time to another. The plans were flawless for the device. Mr. Maxwell and I were quite the team.
But before we went forward with making the prototype, someone got cold feet.
You know, I began to think of the implications of such a device. I began pondering that it was no longer a matter of could, but instead should we make this device. If it fell into the wrong hands, the results could be disastrous. Of course, Mr. Maxwell strongly disagreed with me and informed me that he would be submitting the project anyway. And he left me no choice because of this.
I remember it like it was yesterday. This scoundrel reported me to the school board and they promptly expelled me.
You know, Maxwell, I never knew what happened to you after you were kicked out of school.
Let's just say I found a benefactor who believed in my work.
Yeah, his name is Felix Casablanca.
I knew it!
I've been tracking this heist from the beginning. I was planning on helping with the entire transport, knowing that it would lead me to not only to all the stolen goods, but to Casablanca himself. But when you guys showed up and I knew Maxwell was about to blast you to who knows where, I had to step in and do something.
Sadly for you, your kick didn't fully destroy the transparay. I'm sure it will work one last time. Goodbye, Mr. Snack!
Don't do it, Maxwell. There's no telling where he'll end up if you transport him with the ray damaged like that.
Frankly, Thurl, or whoever you are, I don't care where he ends up. Farewell, Mr. Snick. Don't forget to write!
Snick, no!
Annie, no!
Looks like I got two for one. Did that foolish girl really think she could save that old fool by jumping in front of the blast like that? What on earth is happening?
Looks to me like the transfer ray is about to explode.
No!
Al, get to cover!
Are you okay, Freddy?
Yeah. You?
I think so. Oh, but Maxwell got away.
For now he did. If only Annie and Sneck were so lucky.
Oh, Freddy, what do you think happened to him?
There's really no way of knowing.
I mean, there has to be a way to get him back, right?
There was, but Maxwell blew it up.
What are we gonna do?
I don't know, Al. I don't know.
So when the smoke cleared from the explosion, you said Maxwell was gone?
That's right, officer.
Thank you, Mr. Stewart. That's all we need for now. We'll let you know when we find out about your friends and the whereabouts of Mr. Maxwell.
Thank you.
Well, now I guess we just wait.
Man, what a total loss. Our friends are transported to who knows where. Maxwell escaped, and the explosion from the Transparay ruined all the artifacts not protected by Sneck's display cases. Freddy, there has to be millions of dollars in artifacts lost.
We just have to hope that Sneck and Annie are safe, Al. That's pretty much all we can do.
Excuse me, I couldn't help overhearing the officer speaking to you two. Are you Alex Stewart and Freddy Martin?
Yeah, we are. Why do you ask?
Well, this is really, really odd, but as I was trying to salvage the wreckage here, I came upon this postcard.
A postcard? With a photo of the World's Fairgrounds on the cover. That's not shocking. After all, we're in a World's Fair exhibit.
It's not the postcard that's shocking. It's what's written on the back. Take a look.
Okay. So it says here, Dear Alex and Freddy? Maxwell's plan failed. Sneck and I are alive and well. The ray transported us to 1963. We spent the last year trying to come up with a way to get back. We can't find all the parts to recreate a transparay yet. The key may be at the World's Fair. Maybe I'll meet Walt in person. We will make it back, I promise. In the meantime, know that we are safe. No need to worry about us. Continue the show without me. I'll be back soon enough. Your friend, Annie Rugit.
It's shocking that she was able to fit all of that on a single postcard.
But Freddy, they're both alive!
And going to the World's Fair, it looks like. Man, I kind of wish I'd thought of jumping in front of the beam like that.
I'm so glad they're safe, but I don't have a co-host anymore.
That's true.
Where am I going to find someone who loves Disney history to host this show with me?
That could be tough, Al.
You know, it would need to be someone I know and enjoy chatting with.
Yeah, definitely a tough, tough search.
Hey, I know! Freddy!
Yes?
No, I mean, Freddy, would you want to do the show with me until Annie finds her way back?
Aw. Al, those are big shoes to fill. What are they, like 8 1/2s? But I'd be happy to help you until Annie returns.
You know, ever since we explored the secrets behind the SEA, I've been thinking it would be great to have you on the show again. But after you fled into the jungle that night we played Pin the Tail on the Tiger in the Cambodian Shrine, I haven't been able to track you down. So here I'm officially asking, what do you say? Do you want to join me on this adventure?
Wow. I'd be honored, Al, but Seriously, what happens if I get another lead on the search for Maxwell and, more importantly, Casablanca?
Well, Freddy, then you can guarantee I'll be there to help you track him down.
All right. Well, in that case, I say, what are we waiting for? Let's do this.
Excellent. Come on, Freddy. Toontown awaits.
Welcome to the backside of water family, Freddy. These two are sure to get into some serious antics while exploring the very rich history, awesome stories, and fascinating details behind their favorite Disney attractions. This special episode of The Backside of Water was written by Harrison Ownby and Alex Stewart, and directed by Alex Stewart. Our voice talent includes a special appearance by Michael Mulligan as Stephen Maxwell. You can find his adventures on Instagram at Captain Cosplay. Our regular players are Annie Rugit, Freddie Martin, and Alex Stewart, as themselves, and any other voices heard on today's episode. Be sure to follow along with the adventures of this backside of water crew by subscribing to this podcast and consider giving it a friendly 5-star review. Be sure to also follow us on Instagram and Facebook by searching for the Backside of Water Podcast. So until next time, as you exit, please watch your head and watch your step. And if you happen to miss your step and hit your head, please watch your language.